Welcome to The Milk Check, a podcast from TC Jacoby & Company, where we share market insights and analysis with dairy farmers in mind.
So last week, the USDA finally announced their plans to help the dairy industry. And they came out with a package to help dairy farmers. And then they also came out with a package to what they called the food box package that included some food service distributors to get money to food banks and also some bid programs to buy some cheese and butter and other dairy products. The program to help dairy farmers, I think I'd start by saying, was probably underwhelming for most people in the industry. It probably helped smaller producers more than larger producers because it capped the compensation at $125,000 for the one program, and if it included some of the help they put on grains and others, I think it was capped at $250,000. For large farmers, that is really a drop in the bucket. In some of the numbers I've heard out there, probably doesn't help some of those larger farmers by more than, you know, 15, 16, 17 cents a hundredweight. Now, for the larger, for the smaller producers, that can potentially be very, very valuable. And if they're covering 85% of the losses and 85% of the drop in price from where they were in January to where they were by the middle of April, it probably is going to end up being very helpful. But for the industry as a whole, these days over 70-75% of the milk comes from larger producers. And so you ended up with a program that probably did not help the majority of producers, at least from a milk perspective, in the industry. The other thing it did not include, it didn't include anything that would incentivize reducing the milk supply, because it was a direct payment program. And so the USDA will pay farmers directly, which means that it can't be used to incentivize producing less milk so that we can avoid dumping milk. But that also is the third issue, is there was nothing in the announcement at all to help with paying for the milk that was dumped, because so many processors had lost enough food service sales that they simply were not in a position to take milk. And so they had to push back on their contracts and simply not take the milk. And in many cases, there were force majeure declarations, or in some cases, they didn't even take it that far. They just said, we can't take it. And the co-ops had no choice but to dump the milk because they had nowhere else to go with it. So that USDA program, you know, I would say has been underwhelming. And I don't know, Dad, do you have any other thoughts as to what you're hearing about how farmers are reacting to the program?
Well, I haven't really heard how they're reacting. I don't think we're far enough into it. At this point, all these programs are simply discussions. Nothing at this point has been written in stone. My comment would be with regard to the $125,000. You're right. It is a drop in the bucket, and it addresses, you know, 20 or 25% of the milk supply and leaves the other 70% or so out. So they don't participate in that program at all. It strikes me, and then they're talking about purchasing programs, and then the secretary actually vocalized an aversion to any remuneration for dumped milk with the theory that, oh no, we're not going to do that. We're going to buy products and we're going to distribute it to the poor, or we're going to buy it through CCC, which CCC's program was antiquated 30 years ago. The problem with the CCC program is they buy powder and butter and cheese, and they put it in storage, and then that product hangs over the market for, in some cases, years, until ultimately it's wound up selling back to the trade at a discount. So it distorts the price discovery of the dairy industry until such time as the inventories are exhausted. Feeding the poor, of course, all of us, in small, large, all dairy farmers, virtually all Americans, want to take care of the poor with regard to food and so on. However, in a lot of cases, the dairy products that wind up being produced and packaged to go to the poor wound up being substituted for sales off the grocery store shelf. And that further distorts the reaction. So my observation on the secretary's views of it is that he's looking at things from 30 years ago. And he's not looking at the problem today with the international markets that we have and the way products are produced and who produces them and the way the industry has developed with regard to the factors of production and the efficiencies of production over the last 30 or 40 years. So I think that he's outdated in that to that extent. And I think he needs to wake up a little bit.
So I'll have a little bit of a counter argument on the CCC. I agree with you. It is, for the most part, an outdated program. But I think one of the issues that the USDA had was working with what they already know versus inventing something new on the fly. And the CCC program was one that there was already an apparatus in place, already a process for awarding those bids that they could use and leverage, and I think that's why they did it. The other program, which was the Food Box program, where they're allocating $100 million a month, as long as we're in a federal state of emergency, to have food distributors buy cheese and distribute it to food banks and faith-based, charitable groups to help feed people who've lost their jobs. You know, that program was something that they created very quickly to try and get food in the hands of those who need it as fast as possible. Now, having said that, in that particular program, you have kind of the other extreme. They put it together so quickly that there's a lot of details that were left out, a lot of things that maybe weren't completely thought through. And so there's a lot of skepticism in the industry right now. And when I say, in this case, I'm referring to cheese manufacturers, processors, and distributors, there's a lot of skepticism that that program will have the kind of impact that it needs to have on demand and the kind of impact needed in order to get that food in the hands of those who need it. The bids are due, frankly, this is Friday, April 29th, I believe, today. And I believe the bids are due today for this program. And I've talked to a number of people in the industry and was on a couple of the USDA calls. You know, after they gathered the details of the program, they didn't think it was a program that they could properly take advantage of. I do think some of the food service distributors are going to do their best to take advantage of it. But that kind of leads me to the next little bit of irony, which is by the time they have this program in place, the other thing we're starting to see is a little bit of demand come back on the food service side of the sector. It's basically the end of the month of April. And most people have been cooped up for, 6 to 8 weeks. There is starting to be protests in places about some of these stay-at-home orders. There are people who are starting to basically defy the orders and say, we're going to open up our restaurants. We're going to go back to normal. We really don't have a choice. And while that can be pretty dangerous from a health perspective, and I think we all can have a lot of discussion about whether or not that's a smart thing to do, what we are seeing is that we're starting to see some increased demand out there for cheese and butter and other dairy products as distributors are starting to see an increase in their needs and in their orders moving forward. So it looks like we're starting to see the beginnings of demand coming back into the marketplace, which is the best solution to what we're dealing with. I think you've got to take a wait and see attitude.
I would observe that the increase in demand might have a lot to do with the fact that the price of milk to the, at least as far as the federal order prices are concerned, is about, what is it, Anna, $2 or $3 a hundredweight lower in May than it was in April. So producers or handlers, processors, co-ops that are sitting there paying their producers are going to be financially better off to handle milk in May than they are in April. And I think a lot of the demand might be due primarily to that reason. Now, that said, I think April is going to be at the, as far as pay prices is concerned, and maybe it'll work out about the same. But just the same, there is this big difference, and I think everybody is aware of that, and I'm sure the demand will be there. Another thing that I would point out when it comes time to talk about what kind of program we ought to be having, and we've been having these meetings internally with regard to milk production and supply and demand and how much milk is being generated. Simplistically, the consensus is a 1% increase. This was before the pandemic issue began to be an issue. A 1% increase in milk supply on an annual basis, on a year-on-year basis, was acceptable, and anything over 1% was unacceptable and would tend to depress milk pricing. And we were going into the flush, and all of us were becoming rather skeptical as to whether pricing was going to hold up during the flush or not. Now, of course, it's moot now, but this was two or three months ago when we were worried about having excess production. And then it turned out that if you count the dump milk that's involved in this whole fiasco, that production was up 2.7%. We would have been in a mess even if we didn't have a pandemic with the production that we have. You know, people evidently aren't really looking at the bigger picture. They're looking at giving the help that the dairy farmers obviously need. But at the same time, we've got too much milk, and we've got to cut back on that milk. Now, some one area, I think it's the Texas area, they came out with a program and said, we're only going to play for 90% of the milk produced during such and such a month, I think April. But and that, I think, has taken the bull by the horns and putting it where it is. USDA winding up buying milk through the CCC programs and then buying milk at prevailing prices and selling it, giving it away to the poor, doesn't do a hell of a lot to reduce milk supply and to increase prices for milk and to the dairymen as we go forward through the rest of the year. So a little broader perspective with these programs, I think, would be very much in order.
I think to go a little bit further with your statement too, one of the things that I have been really curious about with how they're going to do any kind of aid to producers is how they would calculate what the loss is. If you have, you know, if we're oversupplied and prices would have been lower anyways, how do you evaluate what you would give them when that's part of the equation? And honestly, you know, more and more, and maybe I'm totally wrong, I almost hope that I am, I just feel like the only way they're going to do this is look at the drop in prices from January to, you know, I guess April 15th was the first portion of the year, and just say it was this much of a drop, you get 85% of that on your volume, because there's no way to evaluate any of the other losses, the dump milk, the premiums, you know, the distressed premiums that we've seen, and to compensate for all of those things. I don't think farmers are going to get any of that.
Unfortunately, I think most dairymen have trouble, particularly the smaller dairymen, have trouble with the perspective of how pricing is determined. Basically, price is determined by the value of cheese and butter and powder, and everything is built on that. You know, supporting the price of cheese and butter and powder beyond the actual market value doesn't get it done. It doesn't send the right messages. And then to buy the products on the market, put them in inventory and pay the storage costs and bring them back either a few months or a year later depresses the price to the dairyman. All it does is level the whole situation out and does nothing to decrease production. These are issues that have to be grappled with, and it's easier for us to talk about it than it is for these people to get things done. But somehow we have to come up with a fair system that addresses the marketplace in a way that levels this peak and valley arrangement that you go from total debacle to $25 a hundredweight and then back again. It doesn't get it done for the industry, and it hurts sales. It hurts our customers. But there has to be some way that we can get this done properly.
Well, let me play devil's advocate. Considering that, you know, we're traders and we're salesmen, and for the most part, you know, we strongly believe in free markets. But, you know, the sense has been, I think in our office, and other people in the industry I've talked to, that this particular situation may be the exception to the rule. That figuring out a way to help the dairy farmers and support prices and reduce supply, basically a supply management system for a short period of time, is probably something that should happen given the uniqueness of this situation. Having said that, you know, as we experience with most government programs, once you've done something, it's hard to undo it. And so once you introduce supply management into the system, it's really difficult to make it go away again. And I think that that's one of the reasons that the USDA has been very reluctant to support the industry in that kind of a way. But my question for you is this: is it possibly healthy to go through something like this and reduce the milk supply through the natural means of survival of the fittest, which means, unfortunately, some dairy farmers will exit the business? But in the long run, could that be healthy, because it gives us as an industry the ability to get back to $25 a hundredweight milk? Do you think that's healthy in the long run, or is what's going on right now just too traumatic to really consider that to be healthy for the industry as a whole?
What we have now with the volatility of, let's call it almost 50% of the value, is not healthy from the standpoint of relationships with customers. It's not healthy from the standpoint of relationships with the dairymen and people in between in the supply chain. If you want to talk about chaotic market conditions, and I really don't like that term, but if you want to talk about it, I don't mind a little bit of chaos, but the chaos that we have right now is a little bit of the exception to the rule. But again, if you go back and look at March production numbers, correct me if I'm wrong, but we were up 2.7%. We would have been in a mess this spring anyway. It just that with the pandemic and the loss of the food service sales, our mess is increased exponentially, and we wind up with a lot of milk being dumped. So something I think needs to be done that levels this volatility out. You know, we've had a lot of conversations over the years as an industry about base excess programs. You know, we used to have base excess programs built into the federal order. And I think it was the Quad Cities order that had, and Memphis order years ago, 40 years ago or more, had a base plan. And you had base, and if you produced over, you got nothing but, I think it was class four for your, or whatever reduced value you had for your milk in those days. And people didn't like it. They voted the order out. And the reason they voted it out is because the dairy industry was starting to gravitate technologically to handle bigger and bigger dairies. The efficiencies over the years were increasing, and those that were in a position to take advantage of it wanted to expand, and they didn't want these sorts of restraints on their expansion. And then even today, you go to a really good dairyman and talk about some sort of a base excess program, and their eyebrows will go up, and they won't exactly embrace it, even with the chaos that we have at the moment. So there's a lot of opposition to those kinds of programs. The fact that you can get a group together and do it on their own is probably a lot more effective. You just say, hey, we've got enough. Anything over 90%, we're not paying for. And I think we're going to observe that it's a miracle as to how the milk production has decreased with that kind of an edict from the customer for the dairyman's milk. A co-op can do that. A proprietary cannot. So that's something that might need to be sorted out somewhat. That sort of methodology, I think, is probably a heck of a lot more effective than some of these other brainstorms that some of these people have that stifle the incorporation of technology into the supply chain.
But isn't that something that's better served by the free market than by government intervention?
Yeah. And that's my point. The free market is what did this in the face of this fiasco, the damn pandemic. In retrospect, and it's not over yet, but that looks to me like the kind of approach that's necessary. There's another reality here that I think we need to put on the table that is disagreeable to almost everybody, but probably is better in the long run. And that is that milk that goes into the manure pit doesn't come back to bite you 6 months or a year down the road. If a system could be worked out where we've got too much milk, where the appropriate amount of pain is applied to milk that's discarded at some level of surplus, you still probably would be able to have food programs for the poor, and you'd be able to, for the CCC, maybe to buy a little bit of milk and so on. But at the same time, perhaps something like that would go a long way towards, let's just say, flattening the curve and the volatility that we've had in the industry here. I don't think that we need to eliminate all the volatility, but having 25 instead of 50 would probably be much more desirable than where we are now.
On the Milk Check podcast, we tackle questions and share ideas that move dairy forward. Now we're making it easier for you to get answers to your lingering questions. Do it with one click. Submit your questions online at jacobi.com/askted.
How long is it going to take us to get out of this? Is it a hockey stick recovery? Is it a V-shaped recovery? Is it a W-shaped recovery? And I know we're all guessing here, but how long do you think it's going to be before our economy gets back to humming along at some semblance of the way it was just 2.5 months ago?
Well, I'll defer to Anna on that.
I think it depends on what you mean by some semblance. I mean, are you talking about pretty close to the way things were?
Yeah, I guess I'm talking about, you know, one where, let's say we have an unemployment rate closer to 5% than 10%, where we're not seeing 3.6 million people apply for unemployment a week. It gets more to the regular, you know, 600,000 or so. Where we're seeing demand that is, you know, back to what it used to be. And I'm not talking about what it used to be in terms of, hey, the economy is humming along great. We've got 3.9% unemployment. You know, everybody's doing well. But at least something that's more of a modicum of what we expect in the dairy industry, where we don't have a situation where certain companies and certain farmers are getting absolutely slaughtered because those dairy processors are too food service focused and not retail focused enough. And unfortunately, those certain dairy farmers are supplying those processors rather than retail processors. You know, at what point are we gonna be back to, you know, everybody going into the office to work, schools, everybody going into school? How quickly are we gonna come out of this?
I honestly can't imagine it being super quick. Now, part of that is I've always felt like my job is easier if I'm the most pessimistic person in the room, because then I'm preparing for the worst. I have a really hard time imagining people just going out to restaurants the way they used to, and that food service has a big impact on us. You know, even if you have the money to do so, I think people are going to be a little reluctant to do it the same way we used to. Whether or not they'll have the money is the other question. And unemployment is, to me, a big piece of this. You know, we're starting to hear farmers talk about how it's hard for them to have labor on their farms right now when unemployment is paying as well as it does. And I think that's true for a lot of companies. You know, that I think is one of the things that I'm most curious about, how it impacts everything in the coming months.
And again, it's right. I think that the unemployment issue and subsidy to be unemployed is poison from that standpoint. However, I think most people would like to have a good job and move forward. I'm not gonna say we're gonna go for a hockey stick. You know, the issue really resides on whether or not we can manage this properly without having lockdown. Or if we have to have lockdowns, we only have them in select situations where people are piled on top of each other, you know, in like a big city or someplace where they have trouble controlling it to the extent that it overwhelms their medical and hospital system. If we can keep it below that, I'm inclined to think that going to a restaurant with a mask, you know, and everybody's wearing a mask, I'm inclined to think people are so anxious to get out that they're going to storm the restaurant, and the restaurants are going to spread the tables out and probably not be able to serve as many people as they did previously, but they'll spread it out and you'll be drinking your cocktail. You lift up your mask, you drink your cocktail, and then pull it back down again. I think that's what you're looking at. And as far as schools are concerned, fortunately, the virus doesn't seem to affect the younger kids and the younger people as much as it does geriatrics like myself. So we have to be a heck of a lot more careful than others. And but
you have to remember too that you're still sending school children home to families with compromised individuals and elderly people. So
yeah,
that's still a concern. I find it really hard to imagine not having the kids back in school next year. But I knew though, I have a couple of friends who do planning at college levels, and they've been told to plan for online learning through the entire year for next year, just in case.
And I think just in case is the key word. I think you're guessing here, but if it comes out and we don't see a spike, we go back to social distancing, but no more lockdown. And we don't see a spike in an unmanageable spike in the cases, that this thing will take off, and probably a U is what we're looking at. In other words, by the time we get, I think Memorial Day is too soon, but by the time we get to Labor Day, after the summer is behind us, and if we don't have any sort of major spike that's uncontrollable, it'll be back to the races. And let's see another thing is, how do you measure this? Do you measure it by the unemployment rate? I think that's one barometer. Do you measure it by the stock market? I think that's a better barometer. If you're if you measure this by the S&P on March 1st or February 1st, versus where it'll be on September 30th, that'll be a good barometer as to where you are, I believe. So there's a lot of variables incorporated into that. Labor is a big, can you get it? Is immigration is part of the issue? Work permits and so on are part of the issue, and it's going to take a lot of work for people to get back to business as usual. And I think there'll be business there, but I don't think it'll be as usual.
And I tend to agree with you. And I would say maybe the way we should measure it is by the milk price. Is the milk price going to get back in September to maybe where it was in February?
I don't think in September, but I think by November or December it would.
Okay.
And my argument is that when the smoke clears, what is the production going to be on an annual basis? And there's another issue here too, Teddy. The food service has virtually cleaned out their supply chain. You know, you hear stories about them giving food away and package programs and so on to food for the poor and charitable organizations and so on, and writing it off. When they get back in business and when pizza joints start cranking up again, they're going to have to stock up on cheese. That's not going to cause a lot of dislocation come August, September.
Well, and that
think,
to me, that's...
I think
that's,
that filling that supply line is going to be a big issue.
Well, and I agree, but that's also why I tend to think we're going to have a W-shaped recovery, because I think you're going to try and refill the supply line, and I actually think that'll happen in July. I think June and July we could get pretty busy as everybody kind of starts to go back to normal. You refill the food service supply line, you get the restaurants starting to open back up, but then once it's opened up, I think that there's going to be this moment where we all kind of realize, you know, demand isn't as good as it used to be. There's the employment rate, unemployment rate is still high. People are still reluctant to get out. You know, the sporting events are still not really happening yet because that's too many people in one building. You know, and as a result, you start to see your cheese price and therefore your milk price come back down, not all the way down to where, you know, $1 a pound for cheese, but maybe back down to where we are right now at around $1.20. Because you still have an overhang of inventories, you still have almost as much milk as you did initially, and demand just isn't quite as good as it had been before this all started. And so I'm inclined to think that our recovery is going to be W-shaped, and you're going to have to work through the system a bit, and it may not be till next spring. If we go through this fall, we don't have a second wave of infections and we get into next spring, and next spring is a normal spring versus the spring we've just had, you know, then you're going to start seeing everything kind of stabilize and go back to normal. And so my gut would be that, you know, it's going to be next summer, the summer of 2021, before we see, let's say, $18 milk again.
No, I think you're too bearish. The issue will come down to whether or not the virus is controllable. So we don't really know, but let's assume that it will be. It's beginning to look like it will be, at least to me at least. And I think we'll know that by Memorial Day, by the end of May, that we'll probably have a pretty good idea as to whether it's manageable or whether or not we're going to have a spike. And if we have a spike, given the pattern of flu, which evidently this seems to follow, the spike will not be in the summer. The spike will be next winter. So So that will be, and that would then, the question is it manageable? And I don't think anybody will want to shut down if they don't have to. You know, we've had seasons where everybody's got the sniffles and coughing and so on from flu. And it may be that that's the kind of thing we're looking at. We don't really know. This thing is much more contagious, but the way things are looking, we're all probably going to get it at one point or another. If it's going to spread itself out all over the whole summer, and then the spike is going to come when the weather cools down, by that time it's over. We'll have a higher participation at the hospital and so on, but It won't cause a major economic debacle.
Yeah, I think the term they're using is herd immunity.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at. But we're not anywhere close to that right now. We got, I think, from what I've been reading, 4 or 5% people have had it and are past it. And we don't even know whether or not there's going to be a second wave or not, whether immunity is actually developed.
Yep. Okay, well, we'll see.
Toby, can you get the dog barks out of it?
I think go ahead and leave them in.
I do too.
They're really normally pretty well mannered, but I'm sitting here talking on the phone, and they're feeling ignored, and that's where the barking comes from.
We welcome your participation in the Milk Check. If you have comments to share or questions you want answered, send an email to podcast@jacobi.com. Our theme music is composed and performed by Phil Kagi. The Milk Check is a production of TC Jacobi and Company. Mm-hmm.